Chapter 19. Covering a multitude of sins, it was interesting when I dressed before daylight, to peep out of window, where my candles were reflected in the black panes like two beacons, and finding all beyond still enshrouded in the indistinctness of last night, to watch how it turned out when the day came on. As the prospect gradually revealed itself, and disclosed the scene over which the wind had wandered in the dark, like my memory over my life, I had a pleasure in discovering the unknown objects that had been around me in my sleep. At first they were faintly discernible in the mist, and above them the later stars still glimmered. That pale interval over, the picture began to enlarge, and fill up so fast, that at every new peep I could have found enough to look at for an hour. Imperceptibly my candles became the only incongruous part of the morning, the dark places in my room all melted away, and the day shone bright upon a cheerful landscape, prominent in which the old Abbey Church, with its massive tower, threw a softer train of shadow on the view than seemed compatible with its rugged character. But so from rough outsides I hope I have learned, serene and gentle influences often proceed. Every part of the house was in such order, and everyone was so attentive to me, that I had no trouble with my two bunches of keys, though what with trying to remember the contents of each little storeroom drawer and cupboard, and what with making notes on a slate about jams, and pickles, and preserves, and bottles, and glass, and china, and a great many other things, and what with being generally a methodical old maidish sort of foolish little person, I was so busy that I could not believe it was breakfast time when I heard the bell ring. Away I ran, however, and made tea, as I had already been installed into the responsibility of the teapot. And then, as they were all rather late, and nobody was down yet, I thought I would take a peep at the garden and get some knowledge of that too. I found it quite a delightful place in front, the pretty avenue and drive by which we had approached, and where, by the by, we had cut up the gravel so terribly with our wheels, that I asked the gardener to roll it, at the back, the flower garden, with my darling at her window up there, throwing it open to smile out at me, as if she would have kissed me from that distance. Beyond the flower garden was a kitchen garden, and then a paddock, and then a snug little rick yard, and then a dear little farmyard. As to the house itself, with its three peaks in the roof, its various shaped windows, some so large, some so small, and all so pretty, its trellis work, against the south front for roses and honeysuckle, and its homely, comfortable, welcoming look it was, as Ada said when she came out to meet me with her arm through that of its master, worthy of her cousin John, a bold thing to say, though he only pinched her dear cheek for it. Mr. Skimpole was as agreeable at breakfast as he had been overnight. There was honey on the table, and it led him into a discourse about bees. He had no objection to honey, he said, and I should think he had not, for he seemed to like it, but he protested against the overweening assumptions of bees. He didn't at all see why the busy bee should be proposed as a model to him. He supposed the bee liked to make honey, or he wouldn't do it, nobody asked him. It was not necessary for the bee to make such a merit of his tastes. If every confectioner went buzzing about the world banging against everything that came in his way, and egotistically calling upon everybody to take notice that he was going to his work and must not be interrupted, the world would be quite an insupportable place. Then, after all, it was a ridiculous position to be smoked out of your fortune with brimstone as soon as you had made it. You would have a very mean opinion of a Manchester man if he spun cotton for no other purpose. He must say he thought a drone the embodiment of a pleasanter and wiser idea. The drone said unaffectedly, "You will excuse me, I really cannot attend to the shop. I find myself in a world in which there is so much to see, and so short a time to see it in, that I must take the liberty of looking about me, and begging to be provided for by somebody who doesn't want to look about him." This appeared to Mr. Skimpole to be the drone philosophy, and he thought it a very good philosophy, always supposing the drone to to be willing to be on good terms with the bee, which, so far as he knew, the easy fellow always was, if the consequential creature would only let him, and not be so conceited about his honey. He pursued this fancy with the lightest foot over a variety of ground, and made us all merry, though again he seemed to have as serious a meaning in what he said as he was capable of having. I left them still listening to him, when I withdrew to attend to my new duties. They had occupied me for some time, and I was passing through the passages on my return with my basket of keys on my arm, when Mr. Jarndyce called me into a small room next his bedchamber, which I found to be in part a little library of books and papers and in part quite a little museum of his boots and shoes and hat boxes. "Sit down, my dear," said Mr. Jarndyce. "This, you must know, is the growlery. When I am out of humor, I come and growl here." "You must be here very seldom, sir," said one. "Oh, you don't know me," he returned. "When I am deceived or disappointed in the wind, and it's easterly, I take refuge here. The growlery is the best used room in the house. You are not aware of half my humors yet. My dear, how you are trembling." "I could not help it. I tried very hard, but being alone with that benevolent presence, and meeting his kind eyes, and feeling so happy, and so honored there, and my heart so full, I kissed his hand. I don't know what I said, or even that I spoke. He was disconcerted and walked to the window, I almost believed with an intention of jumping out, until he turned, and I was reassured, by seeing in his eyes, what he had gone there to hide. He gently patted me on the head, and I sat down. "There, there," he said. "That's over. Pooh! Don't be foolish." "It shall not happen again, sir," I returned, "but at first it is difficult." "Nonsense," he said. "It's easy, easy. Why not? I hear of a good little orphan girl without a protector, and I take it into my head to be that protector. She grows up, and more than justifies my good opinion, and I remain her guardian and her friend. What is there in all this? So, so. Now, we have cleared off old scores, and I have before me thy pleasant, trusting, trusty face again. I said to myself, 'Esther, my dear, you surprise me. This really is not what I expected of you.' And it had such a good effect, that I folded my hands upon my basket and quite recovered myself." Mr. Jarndyce, expressing his approval in his face, began to talk to me as confidentially as if I had been in the habit of conversing with him every morning for I don't know how long. I almost felt as if I had. "Of course, Esther," he said, "you don't understand this chancery business?" And of course I shook my head. "I don't know who does," he returned. "The lawyers have twisted it into such a state of bedevilment that the original merits of the case have long disappeared from the face of the earth. It's about a will and the trust's under a will, or it was once. It's about nothing but costs now. We are always appearing, and disappearing, and swearing, and interrogating, and filing, and cross-filing, and arguing, and sealing, and motioning, and referring, and reporting, and revolving about the Lord Chancellor and all his satellites, and equitably waltzing ourselves off to mouldy death, about costs. That's the great question. All the rest, by some extraordinary means, has melted away. But it was, sir," said I, "to bring him back, for he began to rub his head, about a will?" "Why, yes, it was about a will, when it was about anything," he returned. "A certain Jarndyce, in an evil hour, made a great fortune, and made a great will. In the question how the trusts under that will are to be administered, the fortune left by the will is squandered away. The legatees under the will are reduced to such a miserable condition that they would be sufficiently punished if they had committed an enormous crime in having money left them, and the will itself is made a dead letter. All through the deplorable cause, everything that everybody in it, except one man, knows already is referred to that only one man who don't know it to find out all through the deplorable cause, everybody must have copies, over and over again, of everything that is accumulated about it in the way of cartloads of papers or must pay for them without having them, which is the usual course. For nobody wants them, and must go down the middle, and up again through such an infernal country dance of costs, and fees and nonsense and corruption as was never dreamed of in the wildest visions of a witch's Sabbath. Equity sends questions to law, law sends questions back to equity, law finds it can't do this, equity finds it can't do that. Neither can so much as say it can't do anything, without this solicitor instructing, and this counsel appearing for A, and that solicitor instructing, and that counsel appearing for B, and so on through the whole alphabet, like the history of the apple pie. And thus, through years and years, and lives, everything goes on, constantly beginning over and over again, and nothing ever ends. And we can't get out of the suit on any terms, for we are made parties to it, and must be parties to it, whether we like it or not. But it won't do to think of it. When my great uncle, poor Tom Jarndyce, began to think of it, it was the beginning of the end. The Mr. Jarndyce, sir, whose story I have heard. He nodded gravely. I was his heir, and this was his house, Esther. When I came here, it was bleak indeed. He had left the signs of his misery upon it. How changed it must be now, I said. It had been called, before his time, the Peaks. He gave it its present name and lived here shut up, day and night poring over the wicked heaps of papers in the suit and hoping against hope, to disentangle it from its mystification, and bring it to a close. In the meantime, the place became dilapidated, the wind whistled through the cracked walls, the rain fell through the broken roof, the weeds choked the passage to the rotting door. When I brought what remained of him home here, the brain seemed to me to have been blown out of the house too, it was so shattered and ruined. He walked a little to and fro after saying this to himself with a shudder, and then looked at me, and brightened, and came and sat down again with his hands in his pockets. I told you this was the growlery, my dear. Where was I? I reminded him, at the hopeful change he had made in Bleak House. Bleak House, true. There is, in that city of London there, some property of ours which is much at this day, what Bleak House was then. I say property of ours, meaning of the suits, but I ought to call it the property of costs, for costs is the only power on earth that will ever get anything out of it now, or will ever know it for anything but an eyesore and a hurtzer. It is a street of perishing blind houses, with their eyes stoned out, without a pane of glass, without so much as a window frame, with the bare blank shutters tumbling from their hinges and falling asunder, the iron rails peeling away in flakes of rust, the chimney sinking in, the stone steps to every door, and every door might be death's door, turning stagnant green, the very crutches on which the ruins are propped decaying. Although Bleak House was not in Chancery, its master was, and it was stamped with the same seal. These are the Great Seal's impressions, my dear, all over England the children know them. How changed it is, I said again. Why, so it is, he answered much more cheerfully, and it is wisdom in you to keep me to the bright side of the picture. The idea of my wisdom. These are things I never talk about, or even think about, excepting in the growlery here. If you consider it right to mention them to Rick and Otta, looking seriously at me, you can. I leave it to your discretion, Esther. I hope, sir, said one. I think you had better call me guardian, my dear. I felt that I was choking again. I taxed myself with it, Esther, now, you know you are. When he feigned to say this slightly, as if it were a whim instead of a thoughtful tenderness. But I gave the housekeeping keys the least shake in the world as a reminder to myself, and folding my hands in a still more determined manner on the basket, looked at him quietly. I hope, guardian, said I, that you may not trust too much to my discretion. I hope you may not mistake me. I am afraid it will be a disappointment to you to know that I am not clever, but it really is the truth, and you would soon find it out if I had not the honesty to confess it. He did not seem at all disappointed. Quite the contrary. He told me, with a smile all over his face, that he knew me very well indeed, and that I was quite clever enough for him. I hope I may turn out so, said I, but I am much afraid of it, guardian. You are clever enough to be the good little woman of our lives here, my dear, he returned playfully. The little old woman of the child's, I don't mean Skimpole's, rhyme. Little old woman, and whither so high? Apostrophe, apostrophe, to sweep the cobwebs out of the sky. Apostrophe, you will sweep them so neatly out of our sky in the course of your housekeeping, Esther, that one of these days we shall have to abandon the growlery and nail up the door. This was the beginning of my being called old woman, and little old woman, and cobweb, and Mrs. Shipton, and Mother Hubbard, and Dom Durden, and so many names of that sort, that my own name soon became quite lost among them. However, said Mr. Jarndyce, to return to our gossip. Here's Rick, a fine young fellow full of promise. What's to be done with him? Oh, my goodness, the idea of asking my advice on such a point. Here he is, Esther, said Mr. Jarndyce, comfortably putting his hands into his pockets and stretching out his legs. He must have a profession. He must make some choice for himself. There will be a world more agglomeration about it, I suppose, but it must be done. More what, guardian? Said one. More agglomeration, said he. It's the only name I know for the thing. He is a ward in Chancery, my dear. Ken Jan Carboy will have something to say about it. Master somebody a sort of ridiculous sexton, digging graves for the merits of causes in a back room at the end of Quality Court. Chancery Lane will have something to say about it. Council will have something to say about it. The Chancellor will have something to say about it. The satellites will have something to say about it. They will all have to be handsomely feed, all round, about it. The whole thing will be vastly ceremonious, wordy, unsatisfactory, and expensive, and I call it, in general, agglomeration. How mankind ever came to be. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.